All right, call the regular and supplemental meeting, call to order a supplemental meeting. Be recessed. We get a moment of silence. Okay. What sort of business? Approve the minutes from the July 10th meeting. I get a motion to approve the minutes.
Move to approve the minutes.
Motion and a second. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. To public comments. Anybody have any public comments? Is it a five star on the telephone?
No.
Okay. All right. Move on to the discussion on the actual experience review, actual evaluation assumptions.
Before I turn it over to Jeff and Caitlin, I think you've met them both, or at least Jeff, at a prior meeting. Jeff and Caitlin are with Siegel. They're our actuarial and they have done experience study is required by Texas state law every 5 years. And what it does is it takes a look at what we thought was going to happen with all of the assumptions with what actually happened, and they'll recommend changes to various assumptions as they go through this. So I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. Thank you. Like Kelly said, the purpose of this, every 5 years, we do a deep dive. We look at every assumption and method that's used to value the liabilities of the plan. Because over time, patterns change, experience changes, mortality improves, salary has been a big driver in this study, changes, retirement patterns. I mean, all that changes over time, so we reset it every 5 years. Sometimes the cost goes up, sometimes it goes down. We're happy with the results here, which we'll get to. But it's this is pretty standard for most public sector plans. Most, you know, these fire drums, most plans do some form of this every few years. This period is for January 20 through December 2024. So COVID was within this period, and we did take that into account when setting assumptions. There were some anomalies here and there, a year or two with, you know, more mortality than expected or more retirements or turnover than expected. So we keep that in mind when setting assumptions. We don't want to use experience we don't expect to repeat when we're setting assumptions. So we do take that into account. Sorry, I got the forward and backwards wrong. we'll go through the different assumptions we look at in a moment. I'm not going to go spend a lot of time on here, but you can see in the current year, far right, the orange is salary experience. You know, salary increases briefly have been much greater than expected. You know that. So this is a salary-based plan. So salary experience does directly impact pension costs. So this, I like this page.
Just to interrupt that, it's commonly discussed over at the city, and I think our members think this too, that the only reason that we have gains and losses have to do with investments. And you can see there's just so much more. The city hires, they give raises, they don't hire, people die, they die. There's so much more to that. I mean,
so they don't realize the drop run on the bank caused a big chunk of
that. I think was very clear, that the run on the bank, the run on the bank actually was a liquidity issue, but it also got rid of that liability
right.
As well.
Yeah, but that's not that you don't know, but that went from 2016 benefit payments were, I believe, $275 million, and 2017 were $825 million. So it was that, right?
The real estate developer having value and being liquid are two different things, that if somebody shows up and asks for liquidity on the wrong day,
right,
have the value.
So that was on the heels of 125 basis point drop in discount rate in 2015, writing off $500 million in assets, the run on the bank. It was a perfect storm that worked all against you. I mean, completely against the system. It happened in a very short time frame. So you're still feeling the shock of that.
And so even with that, we still have the ADC conversation, because it would seem like that would drive you to pay the bills that they come to.
who to drive who to pay the bills.
City to pay the bills.
You would, yeah.
100%.
You would think. Yeah.
100%.
You would think. Yeah, that's the most important thing, in our opinion, that could happen. The city could do under this system is pay the actual determined contribution every year. Usually, when you see cities or states or you know even or whatever retirement systems that are in trouble, there's a variety of causes, but almost invariably they're not paying what they're supposed to. Mm-hmm. That's the most important thing. Pay. You know, we're not here just to look pretty, you know, travel to Dallas. We're you know what we're talking about. I'm especially not here to look, but we know, you know, we do this. This is what we do, and we know the importance of this, and paying the contribution is the most important thing the city could do for the system. So over the last 5 years, and you can see, you know, the two recent years, you had investment gains overall. Well, this is not just whether you meet your market target. Well, it's whether you meet your actuarial value target, which we'll get to, but this is as a percentage of accrued liability. The last 2 years, you've had investment gains. The four of the past 5 years on the non-investment side, you've had losses, which kind of tells us it is time to reset and take a look at the assumptions. Now, the middle 3 years, 21, 22, 23, you know, when you've got losses or gains that small, we don't even really blink an eye at that because you're going to have variations each year. It just, you know, we can set assumptions that are good, but we can't perfectly predict when people are going to quit, retire, or die, or pay raises. But the outer ends in 2024, the non-investment loss was primarily due to salary experience. The page we looked at here, that big orange blob on the far right, it was almost, which is, you know, it's great when, you know, folks get good pay raises, but steady pay raises work better for retirement system because you can plan better for the cost. You know, I have a different police and fire plan where they'll go years and years with no pay raises at all, and all of a sudden they get a 25% pay bump. I'm like, okay, well, that's a nice pay raise, and then the city asks how come their pension costs went up so much. I'm like, well, pretty obvious if you're paying attention, but. So we did propose quite a few. Like I said, we look at everything, anything that affects the liability. Mortality, we were recommending a change to a more recent mortality table. The PUB 2010 table, the current table you're on, and first of all, I should step back. You know, we propose assumption changes. We can't enforce them. The board has to adopt any changes. So these are our recommendations. They're meant to be taken as a package. If we start parsing stuff out, which we can, but that's we have a set results in here based on all the assumption changes combined. The society actuaries set the mortality tables and generational mortality improvement scales. And anyways, a few years ago, they instituted public sector specific tables. They finally looked at that and they carved out the public sector from the corporate. They set up three tables. They have one just public safety and one for your employees. And one for so we have a public safety specific table. We're recommending updating the tables with some modifications based on the actual experience of your system. And it was interesting, though, in the, which maybe you don't want to hear, but in the most recent tables, we have a couple of folks who worked on with Society of Actuaries establishing the table. I reached out to one of them. I said, tell me if I'm reading this right. So they kind of broke into six sectors for the public safety and public safety general teachers and the male and female. So basically six main groups before they started splitting them up further. Public safety male was the only group whose mortality rates went kind of the wrong way. Mm-hmm. The only one who had more death experience in the period, which was interesting because for the most part, you know, we've heard for years, you know, fire and police folks have said, hey, you know, our mortality is much worse than your employees, and the tables just don't bear that out. But they said this last period they studied, it did on the retiree side bear that out. I don't know why. I asked him about that. He said he debated that for a long time, but, you know, the numbers were what they were, so it was interesting. something to look forward to, I guess. I don't know.
Just a side note. Sorry, I just kind of went off track in my mind.
We already knew it.
So, so we're recommending updating the mortality tables, the mortality improvement scale, which, you know, folks who are born today are expected to live longer than folks who were born 5 or even 10 years ago. So we factor that in. The retirement rates for those in drop and not in drop, we're looking at updating those. Drop utilization, we didn't, there's so few folks going to drop that wasn't, we didn't think that was really worth updating. I mean, pretty much most items, those who retire from terminated vested status, those who worked long enough to be vested in a benefit but left and are no longer working but are due a benefit in the future. The disability rates, turnover rates, even spousal age difference. I mean, we dig in and look at everything. Payroll growth. The biggest driver of results, is this, which we'll get to, is a salary scale. That was the hardest assumption to set because common sense says you can't keep getting
double-digit salary raises paying
every single year. And so it's a matter of what has happened, what's expected to happen. You know, there's not a new meeting for agreement that we've seen yet. I know the city released their budget on Friday. Well, the study was already, you know, done by that point. So we have, based on the last meeting, or the last, I guess, 2025 agreement.
2022.
The last thing we received, you know, so we have higher increases, either 10 to 14% assumed in this first year, and then it's a lower increases going, I think, scaling from 8 down to 3.5% for future years.
I think it was over the 5 year period, you know, 2020 to 2025, when you're looking at, like, cost of labor has increased significantly,
right,
not just for police and fire, across the board. And it's, does that continue for forever? And it just feels like it can't. I mean, I think this group averaged, I think it was like 9.5%
over the period.
Pay increases,
yeah,
per year over the 5 year period. And that, it doesn't really feel sustainable. And but it was definitely needed to come up from where we were previously and trying to,
yeah,
kind of pinpoint that. And then obviously reflecting that what we know is the pay is going to be for the 2025 pay scales, which are, again, double-digit increases over 24.
And this is something we'll probably look at updating once a new meet for agreement is out and there's stuff that's kind of in writing we can see and base it on. So this an experience study is as much art as science mixed together, and like I said, looking at what's happened, looking for trends, looking at what we expect to happen. Sometimes we hit around and sometimes we don't. But that's something where you don't have to wait 5 years to do the change assumption. We change them as needed. We make recommendations to the board. Y'all will adopt or not adopt any changes. This is one I think will probably definitely change before the next experience study.
One question, actually, I mean, we all realize that this is driving by looking at given that the mortality rate assumptions are driving a lot of the study, do you think, looking at the way the whole curve is shifted out, particularly at its tail, do you think that's a COVID implication that we may not see in the future where, you know, you shifted the curve out, particularly for people who are at a higher age cohort, and it comes back in and now they're kind of...
Yeah, so the mortality improvement scale is something Society of Action had been which one?
16, I think.
Was it the male retiree mortality?
Yeah, you see it in the female mortality.
Are you looking at this?
So one thing too, this the base table, the Pub 2016 updated table, it actually doesn't include COVID experience. I think they went up through 2019.
Yeah, they didn't include COVID experience, and the generational improvement scale is the 2021 scale we updated to. They have not issued one since then because of COVID.
Okay.
They were waiting to see what was going to happen. For a while, they were issuing a new improvement scale every year. But then they put the brakes on that to see I mean, it's a long-term impact, obviously. We don't know what's going to happen long-term. But what they've seen in the short term said, you know, we need to hold off on this until we get a better feel for what's going on. But and we made adjustments to the tables. I don't – does this have all –
mm-hmm.
Yeah, it does.
So it sounds like not to be foolish, but that doesn't reflect COVID. So the next iteration of this could actually be shifted even further out.
Possibly. I don't know if they're – I could see them waiting longer to issue the next tables, kind of excluding like 20 through – like this last 5 years experience or like 20 through 23 or something like that. And, mm-hmm. have longer time period before they issue the next tables. They haven't said that that I'm aware of, but I wouldn't be surprised.
So that 0.86 is actually pretty safe given that this doesn't reflect a pandemic.
Yeah. I mean, we looked at the year-to-year experience mortality, and when we're setting the recommendation, like I said, we don't want to – there's a spike in mortality in, you know, 2021, 22. Well, that's – probably a COVID spike, so we're taking that into account and kind of carving that out a little bit. I mean, the deaths occurred, but we don't expect those rates to occur again at that higher rate. So it's something we try to keep in mind when we're setting these, not just for mortality, but for the turnover and retirement as well.
Yeah, and we're saying, for all of your experience tables, it's kind of funny. You're looking at like a five-year period, and you're just seeing a lot more volatility than you would normally. Turnover too. It's like nobody left during 2020, and then everybody left in 2022, and it's like, okay, well, maybe we zoom out because when you look at the 5-year period nation or on an annual basis, probably get to somewhere closer to what is going to be more reasonable. Same with retirement. It's like, you know, when you look at the year by year basis, you see the spikes, and you think back of like, oh yeah, that tracks with what was happening. The entire
good back testing does. Thank you.
Sure. So we're gonna look off the remote. So we have the impact of each change on the percent of pay or on the ADA percent of pay, the actual determined contribution, and how it impacts the funding ratio. So actually, mortality was the biggest saving in the changes we made because male retiree mortality is expected to be worse than the rates went against us, but fire and police plans are overwhelmingly male. So that you saw a savings there. The payroll growth assumption, but that's so we, you know, the overall payroll growth had been assumed to increase at 2.5%. We changed that to 3.5%. And where that has an impact, that's not the salary scale, but that impacts the amortization payments because you're amortizing over a percent of pay. So when the payroll growth increases, it actually lowers the amortization payment. So as it didn't impact the funding ratio, the payroll growth, but it does impact the ADC, the percentage of pay. But then you can see the salary scale overwhelmingly had the biggest, only two of the assumptions went up. As I'm sure, and Josh can tell you that we've done these studies in the past where experience goes the other way. And I'm on a roll. This is my sixth experience study in the past 9 months. Five of them saw costs go down. It was unbelievable, but it's good, I guess. I don't know. But so the overall change, your actual determined contribution as a percentage of pay went down, and your funding ratio went up. So let's look at the actual numbers. Now, the percentage of pay went down because payroll shot up a lot, but the dollar amount is still, it went down. So the first column, 2024, those are last year's results. You had a deck of $262 million. The column says is a preliminary evaluation results. That's prior to any assumption changes. If we weren't doing the experience study, your ADEC would be the $308.89 million, or 55.42% of pay, projected pay. But after the changes, the $308.89 million actually went down to $304.5 million, or 52.7% of pay. Now, this is obviously the ADEC, not the actual contributions coming in, but it still worked in your favor. Liability went down, but normal costs went up a good bit, which is kind of the cost of the present benefit the year. And that's primarily, what's well, not primarily, it's due to the salary scale.
What is that 58.9 mean? I mean, that's just $58.
Well, kind of it, yeah, that's $59 million. Yeah,
okay.
All the dollars are in millions.
Okay.
I should.
Okay.
So that's like the present value of the benefits accruing in the year. Essentially, that's the easiest way to explain that.
Yeah, like administrative expenses, just like annual cost of accruals for active, and less. You know, obviously the employees.
So out of the 304 ADEC, 59 is for the current employees, and the rest to pay off the liability.
Right.
Okay.
Which I mean, not that there's not current employees current impacted in the unfunded liability.
There's also the difference in timing. The actuarial determined contribution, that's based on, that's projected forward to be paid the beginning of the fiscal year, so 10/1/26 basically. So there is some kind of payroll growth in that number.
Yeah, the 21 months.
Yes.
There's an adjustment for timing in there, but this is a summary. The valuation, which will be at the next meeting, we'll have a further details. The bulk of the payment is paying off the unfunded liability, which makes sense since you're close to $4 billion funded. But as we showed on that page earlier, the unfunded is not at all only due to investments in the past. I mean, certainly that's part of it, but you have assumption changes, plan changes, the cumulative history. It's not just recent. It's kind of everything where you did hit your target over the years.
So there's a lot going on in these numbers, of course, but so first of all, I just wanted to point out in column two, those are preliminary because the assumptions haven't been accepted, but they're also preliminary because the numbers, the asset numbers are not entirely.
That's right. I didn't point. Thank you.
But the other thing is, and this is a question, part of the increase, so this reflects the plan that the board adopted in August. So this has the immediate partial COLA in it, and it has a step up. So is part of the reason that we went from 262 to over 300 because of that step up? It's not just
the biggest driver for the increase was the salary experience.
Right.
That was the biggest component of the demographic loss.
Okay.
On the investment side, it was you had a gain on the investment side. Now, and like I mentioned, I should have pointed out, we received final assets on Monday, I believe. So they weren't dramatically different. They were very, small enough we could have just pushed them. But so we'll up the valuation report, we'll have updated assets. So the actual numbers will be a little bit different than what's shown here, but the relative impact will be roughly the same. It's the assets change was not significant.
So just to understand, this is based on our plan. So this would be the second year of the 3-year step up, the $308 million.
I think it's
yes.
Third year.
No, this is second.
So 2023 was the first year.
Well,
2025 is the first year.
Did we?
1/1/24 was the first year that it was in the valuation. And
yes,
that was the fixed amount. Remember,
those bases were as of
1/1/23. Y'all went retroactive 23.
Oh, right. That's
the bases.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yes, 24 was the first valuation, but that we were already in like year two of the step up. So the.
So this number will be year two or year three?
This is year, the third year of the step up, and then next year will be where it just is a normal.
And that'll increase a little bit because you're.
So. In the ideal world, it would be 308 this year. 250 of that would be going towards 60 million. It says 42 million would be normal cost.
Well, I mean that's part of the recommendations here.
Yes. Yeah.
So if we weren't doing an experience study, then the green column two would be valuation numbers, except for the change in assets.
So actually, the more precise answer is the 304.
If the board adopts the recommended changes, yes.
And then the other thing, Kelly, you made a very good point, and I was going to ask that question. This recommendation. recommendation reflects a plan that is actually not the current plan that the full length, correct?
This is the plan the board adopted, correct?
Yeah.
Right, this is the plan that the board adopted in August, which is different than the statute. And different than the
so, right now, we are not paying a COLA, but this correct. Plan and calculation assumes
it assumes the COLA will start in
October.
October.
Well, the old valuation actually assumed we were paying a COLA. We just weren't paying it until
we were paying it way in the future. Yeah. But it did have a little bit of liability
right.
for that because yeah. based on the...
It was a COLA
yeah.
sooner.
Yeah. So, I mean, we have another 40 pages we could go through, but I don't really think anybody wants to see the minutiae. But we can, if you look through this, if there's any questions you have, we can certainly address anything in here. But these are the highlights. This is what, you know, we've kind of gone through what the changes are, showing the impact. And we can get into the nitty gritty if you'd like, but that's up to the board.
Do we have a simplified version of this, or does staff in the city understand what they've got their own?
So, this is the only version I have, and actually I kind of think what they've provided is kind of a simple version of their actual analysis. The city doesn't have this yet, but they will soon have it. As of today, they'll get it. Deloitte will totally understand this. And as part of the 802 audit that Deloitte did a few months ago, they had recommendations from the prior experience study that Siegel took into consideration when they were doing this one where they addressed most of the problems. So they should understand. They should.
And as a housekeeping matter, we actually have a minimum number of persons for form.
We have two people on the phone. Yeah, we count. And we have six, actually.
Kelly, I have a question. I know the city just came out with their budget. Do you know what they had budgeted for DPFP? I'm curious how it compares to the number on here.
For the pension?
Oh, so $225 million is what they have in.
So that's what they have on their budget.
They budgeted for based on their plan.
Right.
The plan they adopted in September.
I'm curious what the shortage would be. Okay.
80.
So. I guess unless the board has any questions.
Can you talk more about the salary scale? I know that's the, like, maybe slide 8. I mean, I know you had to pick a number because there was really no guidance, and you did reach out to Deloitte to see if they had any more information that might help you. Because what I'm seeing, and I told Caitlin this morning, is the actual salary numbers that the city has used to create their new budget for 2026 is $100 million more in salary than Chiron had for the same year when they did their study, just massive, which is a 20% increase. Huge.
That's kind of there's a lot of things going on. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like the void will assist the city in understanding the biggest issue here is salary.
Right.
And you got a rebate from mortality that, quite frankly, you couldn't have counted on. It's a fact, you know, the number is lower than you would expect.
And the payroll growth assumption, those two things.
Yeah, and I'm sure Deloitte will reach out to us if they have questions. But I mean, they'll certainly understand this. They may have a different take on things, but I'm not worried about that. But if they have questions, I'll reach out to them.
Because I want to keep talking over the ice, trying to get some sort of resolution to get the capital that I don't think this is the plan for it. In fact, I think it's the way it is.
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't, I mean, I guess I'm not, I don't see anything controversial here. I mean, there's nothing outside of the norm that's been recommended. The salary scale is the biggest impact, but That was the biggest shot in the dark.
Not an appraiser, but at some point we got to sell the house.
Well, and if their appraiser would give us information we needed to do this, we could have probably been more.
I gotta say, we reached out to Deloitte and we're like,
yeah, it's in the city.
You got any idea, you know, anything you're hearing, any projections you're seeing from the budget that we could use for setting this?
On the next slide, I mean, maybe I'm not reading this right, but in my mind, you've increased the salary scale based on what our best guess, and also including the fact that the big increases can't go on forever. So you had to pick a number, but you haven't picked some huge high number. That kind of proposed line is well below the linear line. So you've picked, you know, you've increased it, but you haven't totally increased it to harm.
If we set the salary scale based on the actual experience of the past 5 years, and which we didn't run those numbers, but I'm guessing if we'd based the salary scale on actual experience, that 304 million ADEX probably closer to like 320, 325. That's just a complete random guess, but it would be much higher because, like I said, you average, everybody averaged like a 9.5% roughly increase over a 5-year period. That's just not sustainable. That's just not. I mean, no city can be able to afford that, I don't believe. I mean, I can't speak for, obviously I don't work for Dallas, but I don't see how that's sustainable. Let me see if I have one that makes sense in the back here. Might be the very last page. I was looking for the appendix 2. That it flip through it unless it. Sorry, give me a second. So yeah, I guess we'll go to the very last page. Whoops. Sorry. Forgot there's more stuff in here. Oh, I keep getting the wrong way. Keeping the left side like it's a mouse trying to go backwards. It's the there we go. So based on the salary scale, the expected overall was like 3.71% over the period. Actual increase overall is 9.41% on average. That's in the proposed. So the proposed rate shows 8 to 3.5. That does not include. We should have added commentary on there, but it's listed in Appendix 1. Where for the first year, it's either 10 or 14%, depending on rank, based on information we received. So the average, I mean, proposed rate is still a lot less than the actual rate, just because you can't, we just didn't think it was kind of a bit of a common sense, a bit of, we know there were some anomalous years in the 5-year period. You know, we know some of the stuff, some of that stuff has changed what's expected, but we just need better guidance. And like I mentioned, this is one of the assumptions we expect will probably change either next valuation or one after that, depending on when we get some updated information that we can, everybody feels better about.
Yeah, and obviously if 2026 cases come out and they're another 10 to 14%, I think everybody will.
Yeah, I don't think they will.
Not that. Wouldn't make sense for this to be done earlier in the year, the city would have it before they come out with their budget. I mean, I know we're
still ignoring it.
I'm just curious if they would even take it into account. They had this document 3 months ago.
Well, what would make sense is they didn't refer earlier, so then they could use it to project forward. Because this shouldn't, I mean, this is the history of what they've done, not what they're going to do.
Part of the reason it's now is, you know, the period was 20 through 24, so we need the most current year's data and demographic experience to be able to put it into play and some kind of assets. So, which we had the final ones on Monday. We had the draft ones a little while ago, but I can't remember exactly when they came in. But we didn't have everything we needed to be able to do this 3 or 4 months ago.
I just know the argument from the city side will be, well, we've already budgeted this amount. So find a way to stop that in the future.
I mean, they have the 24 numbers, and they didn't use those for their
correct
budget.
They've never used our reports for anything other than
hoping to improve my insurance.
So,
and I know that, you know, some of the salary outside, like a lot of this experience isn't changing dramatically year in, year out, and, you know, some salary, some of it, like what came first, chicken or egg. Like we kind of need to, it'd be nice to have an idea what the city's budgeting to set this, but at a certain point, we just need to set something and go with it. And yeah, their budget is based on the actuarial numbers, but the salary assumption really needs to have an idea of what their budget is too. So, you know, at a certain point.
Yeah, so the appendix two has these type of graphs for the major assumptions, as far as you can kind of see more the nitty gritty, like, you know, turnover for fire. Fire actually had, usually we see more turnover than expected on the police side, on the fire side this time. So the police assumption overall was close to expected. I mean, we tweaked the rate based on the
fact.
Sorry.
What
about 2 months early?
Yeah. But, you know, this is the type of stuff. Police had less turnover than fire, compared to expected, not otherwise. There's hardly enough disabilities to... disability experience matters for the individual, but disability is very, very, very minor. You know, retirement, there were a lot fewer retirements. Drop. Well, also depends on your services. Now look at it. We looked at it, you know, with the plan provision 17, there were different, you know, provisions for when you can retire. So we split those out. We looked at retirement drop, and we split out non-drop a couple different ways. But overall, there was less retirement, a lot less retirement experience than expected over the period. So that's another thing that, you know, we dampened those rates down a little bit. And like here, the police retirement experience was less than half expected, what was expected. So it's... a lot of things worked for you in lowering the cost. It's just a salary experience. Kind of offset a lot of that. But still, the overall ADEC went down.
Part of the reason, too, remembering kind of the mechanics of this fund, the reason mortality is impacted is over 50% of your liability is with retirees. People are in pay status. Really the only assumption we're looking at for this is mortality. So if mortality comes down, that has a bigger impact than retirement. Disability turnover, there's active liability out there, but where you stand today, at least most of it, is in the pay status.
And your numbers are showing that the healthy post-retirement mortality is less than what was expected.
So, well, for the healthy, we had actually more deaths than expected.
For post-retirement. What do you mean for retirement?
So it's healthy post-retirement mortality. It looks like the rate's lower than...
When are we?
Page 61, I guess. Okay. Sorry, I'm
one issue. No, that's me. That's pre-retirement.
That's active death.
Oh. Oh. Oh.
The 61 or pre-retirement.
There's two page numbers on the screen.
Yeah, 48.
Oh, I was looking at our page number. I just now noticed that.
48 for you guys.
Okay, sorry. I was looking. I was like, that's not page 6. Oops. So, this is the assumption. This isn't the actual experience.
Okay.
So, Appendix 2 shows the actual experience. This is what the current rates were assumed to be, and this is what the proposed rates would be. So, yeah, for male experience, the proposed rates are greater than they were before. That was, like I said, the only one of the six main groups in the study that which that occurred. You can see on the female side, the proposed rates for healthy mortality experience all went down. But the actual, let me go back to where we were in Appendix 2 real quick.
58
in our slide, 71 in y'all's. You can see where there was a lot, males are up top, 454 deaths during the period. We expected 373.
Okay.
And the female experiences, you know, 13 deaths compared to almost 15 expected.
So with my understanding is the average male officer in America right now, the life expectancy is 59. So it's good from a perspective. It's good to see that
it's
such a low number at that age, and then
What was 69?
59. Average white male police officer in the United States right now is the average life.
Oh, the average life expectancy or average?
59.
Age?
Yeah, life expectancy.
No.
It was 66, then it went down 57. Then, I mean, that's every number I've seen recently.
Mm.
Okay.
Sorry, I mean, I'm not trying to be. I'm just the tables don't bear that out. This set of tables that obviously went backwards compared to the first public sector tables. The first tables, public safety, which has police and fire and some other included, was pretty close to the general employees once you retired. The Pub 2010 tables, when they first did this, it's not dramatically different. It was a little different, which is why they had different tables, but not hugely. But this one did go the other way. But that's now I'd want to see something that a study that put that out there. That goes against everything we've seen from professionals do this. But I'm not saying there's nothing out there that says that. I just want to read that myself.
I think it was the University of Buffalo study a little while back. I think that's one I read.
All right. But regardless, the male mortality, public safety has kind of reversed a little bit compared to when the tables were first put out. On that happy note, though, I'll get off of this table. These Appendix 1 has all the current and assumed assumptions. We talk about methodology. Pages happened on, but yeah, you can see that in the past 5 years, 3 of the 5 years, you hit your target on the market value side. You had good returns. It's just 22 brought down the 5-year period dramatically. I mean, 20 also, but everybody got hit in 22. That's specific. That's not just you guys. I mean, every system, everybody got hit harder in 22, but you had 3 really good years in the 5-year period in your market returns. That 1 year brings down the whole table. And we didn't really discuss investment rate return because we weren't recommending any changes. You guys are still a little bit ahead of the overall public sector curve. We put you based on the Siegel Market Advisors, capital market assumptions, and your current asset allocation. We got you a 56% chance of hitting your goal over the long term, over the next 20 years. So we want that to be at least 50%. So if anything, Deloitte will probably come back and say, which they did already, you should raise that assumption. And we're like, well, I don't think we should. I mean, you had 3 good years in the last 5, but you need more sustainable period of achieving that to even consider that. But, it's kind of like the rat motel. You go in, you don't come out.
And, I mean, if interest rates really do start coming down, the market assumptions shift, that chance of hitting 6.5% still comes down.
Yeah, so this is a moving target every year, but I think we're comfortable. You got the 6.5, and I don't see any reason to change that.
A naive question. I think Siegel has done this for other firms in the past at some point in time, but is there any benefit to, say, on the actuarially defined contribution, which we have you have a 308.89, to show a chart if the city were to increase what the multiplier effect would be in terms of the benefit, in terms of savings, by putting more money in versus less money? Because there would be a multiplier effect.
I'm sorry, could you?
You mean if they contributed more than the ADP?
Yeah, for every dollar additional. Well, we did this with the legislature. For every additional dollar that was contributed, this would be the benefit, and that encouraged the legislature to, put in more money.
We probably could, but they've never shown any interest in even contributing the ADC. I'm not trying to be a smartass. They haven't. They've never come close to it. Maybe back in the beginning when 34.5% made sense, but it hasn't made sense in a long, long, long time. We could do something like that. I don't know if it's worth the time or the money to spend for us to do it because we've shown them what will happen if they contribute the ADEC. We've shown projections, and they just haven't been willing to do that.
It gets to, what are the goals? Is the idea to really fully fund this thing in 30 years, or is ADEC just a notational number for to show you what you would need again if you really tried to get fully funded by a good point?
Well, when we were looking at the Chiron reports, and there was the five options to fund ADC, there was the totals in each of those, and the city was more concerned about their current budget impact, which I understand, than the total 30-year cost of the city, because they picked the one that is the most expensive over 30 years because you're paying it off the slowest. And they know that.
Yeah,
balance. Yeah, I'm just thinking more of a talking point.
Right.
Yeah, your tremendous talking point, but maybe they finally understand.
Probably. A fund does not need to be 100% to be in good shape, and obviously that's right now, if ever, it's way out in the future, but you still don't want to be in the 30s. It wasn't that long ago. During 2017, as y'all remember, we were projecting insolvency within 15 years. We were literally no money. We're not at that point anymore. All the changes, the impact, but they still need to. It's like Kaylin said, what's the goal of the city? Is it to have a healthy retirement system? Is it to pay the bare minimum for their budget? Because those two don't always go together. If they budgeted, $225 million, that's about a little more than 7% of the ADEC of the recommended changes. And that additional $80 million goes a long way. And each year you're paying in $80-plus million less than you theoretically, technically should be paying. That builds up over time. And it's, we have another 2008 occurrence in the market, all bets are off on solvency. That's what it is. Your cash flow is negative each year as far as benefit payments greater than the contributions coming in. But that's like that for most pension systems, not you guys. Most systems operate cash flow negative, which puts the impetus on your investments. Which, there's only so much you can do to the markets. You can't always count on the markets to work for you. So the more money you have coming in, the healthier the system will be. I think that's an obvious statement. But the best thing they can do to keep this system on the right track is to start paying the ADEC each year.
When you think to the markets, assets at around $2 billion, you could have a banner year, but if your liability is still up almost $5-6 billion, it's not as much of an impact as if you had assets at $4 billion. You don't have to be fully funded for the plan to kind of operate in a more.
I've said this in meetings before. Most plans are not fully funded, and most plans never will be, in my opinion. That's fine. You don't have to be fully funded to be operational and in good shape. But you got to be better than 32% funded because there's not a lot of wiggle room if things go wrong.
Well, plus the way that we seem to like
right.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's, with the kind of plan the way it is, us calculating the ADEC that funded in 30 years, each year that goes on that doesn't get contributed. It is. It just turns out where the ADEC just keeps getting bigger, city keeps not contributing at that level, and it at a certain point becomes a number that is almost useless. But essentially, like I said, it's just notational. It's here's Right. So you could be paying.
They're not paying the mortgage payment. They're paying interest on the mortgage each year. They're paying interest, but they're not actually hidden. They're never paying the principal on this mortgage. They're paying interest toward the principal. You
know. Where are most planned? Like I would, if I were going to speculate, I would think 70% or somewhere in that 70-80.
Yeah, I'd have to look to see what kind of the average is, and it varies a lot. I've got plans that are, you know, 90%+, 80%+, but not many of them. Most of them are 60-70 range, and there's not a whole lot of fully funded plans out there in the public sector. There are certainly some. None that I work on, but there are some. I've got a police plan that's around 90% in Florida. But that city has never not paid for it either. I mean, they're I won't say fanatical, but they've never considered not paying the ADEC, and they're in pretty darn good shape.
I think another, you know, a healthy funded percentage. I always just look at, like I said, look at your liability for people in paid status A. I mean, no one else could retire. You still don't have enough cash in the bank to pay that liability at a bare minimum to get there. Think up to the immediate partial goal that the board adopted doesn't go into effect. So there's no coal in this plan until 70% funded then based on the statute, and it's a long way away if kind of the city keeps agreeing with that.
Well, but the thing it does do, and this is why writing that course is makes your job very difficult when we're flying at the top level.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan, you can't actually throw a long ball. A lot of sense to drive up the actuarial rate of return if we have to get liquid because we're 32% in debt.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. For sure.
What do you think about the 6.5% assumed rate of return? 30% funded. You're limited in what you can invest in and what you can lock up assets in. Just like that, yeah, you need. You're very reliant on your investment income to pay off.
So we will be assuming if the board adopts the recommended changes, we'll be back at next month's meeting to present the evaluation with all the adopted changes.
There's no more questions. John, can you take us back to our slide 13? Maybe you can back up. Okay.
I can do it real quick.
Two motions. One, if you agree, is to accept and review the actuarial experience study and submit document to CRB, which is required. And then a second would be to provide direction to Siegel on the assumptions used in preparing the January 1, 2025 evaluation report, if you agree with all the assumption changes here. We've got two on the phone, Robin.
NC.
Oh, Rob Michael. Steve. We've got three on the phone.
Okay. All right, so
step down.
Huh?
You can wait.
Wait. Both come back in. Is it right? Okay. So can we get a motion then? So the question is, can we get a motion to accept and review the actual experience and submit document to the PRB.
So moved.
I got a second?
I'll second.
Okay, we have a motion and a second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. Hearing none, the motion passes. Now we need a motion to provide direction to Siegel on the assumptions to be used preparing the January 1, 2025 25 actuarial evaluation reports for the regular plan, combined plan, and the supplemental plan. I get a motion. A second?
Second.
Okay. Seconds. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? By saying nay. Hearing none, the motion passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're like, okay. Yeah. If we go forward with it.
Yeah.
308 is a long way from 225. I was all excited about the 225 because in my head I was thinking this is the 2023 numbers, right?
Yeah.
308 is a big jump.
That's a lot of money.
Yeah, it is.
But they have it. Look, we got billions to throw. We got FIFA.
Yeah.
FIFA money coming in. What are we worried about?
Yeah. Give us a taste, you know?
Yeah, exactly. What might be? What might be?
Yeah. We use that argument to hear us.
Literally. Because we can explain to city council members.
It's a hell of an investment.
This dollar today equals $3.
Yeah. And it worked.
Yeah. Because they don't understand how shit is. It's actually showing up.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, it looks like it.
All right. Are you ready?
Yes.
Ready. Good morning.
Good morning.
Today I will begin with the 2025 mid-year budget review. During this review, we will look at the actual versus budget results for the administrative, professional, and investment expenses for the first 6 months of 2025. Generally, some reasons for the variances include the budget is created on an annual basis and then straight-lined over the year. Some expenses are heavier in the earlier part of the year, like payroll taxes, that creates a negative variance in the first half of the year, but typically they will be within budget by the end of the year. And finally, some expenses come in a lumpier fashion with large invoices covering a period or a project like IT projects or audit fees. As we go through the presentation, we will examine some of the largest variances in more detail. The system budget year is January through December. The budget adoption policy requires a mid-year budget review each August, and the 2025 annual budget is $19.3 million, and as I said, it is straight-lined over the year. That $19.3 million is allocated in these percentages, or it adds up to these percentages. 56% of the budget is for investment expenses, 34% for administrative expenses, and 10% is for professional expenses. In the summary budget, we track three broad categories of expenses: administrative, professional, and investment. So here we are as we look at the summary budget table, kind of lay out the table itself. On the left-hand side, you have the expense types that we talked about, then 2025 6 months actual, 2025 budget, 2024 6 months actual, and then the 2025 actual versus budget dollar variance and percentage variance. So as we look at the big picture, the mid-year budget for 2025 is $7.6 million,
And when we compare that to the 2025 actual of $7.169 million, we are under budget by $480,000 or 6.3% through June. Now let's take a deeper look at administrative expenses. The administrative expenses have been summarized into four categories: employee expenses, IT-related expenses, building expenses, and then all other admin expenses. The actual expenses for this group were $2.97 million compared to the budget of $3.273 million, or we are under budget by $298,000 or 9.1% of the budget. The largest budget variance here is in the IT-related area, and it is related to the timing of the pension administration software project. We expect more expenses in the second half of the year, and then that will take care of some of that variance. As we look at the employee and building expenses, they are close to budget with overall variances of 1.3% or less. And that final category of all other admin expenses, it's under budget by $48,000. Liability insurance was the biggest part of that. It's under budget by $23,000 because the actual policy renewal came in under our projection. We were happy about that too. Here's a chart that I wanted to show you. It's a comparison of those same three time periods that we were discussing, looking at the same four categories. And you can see generally the variances or all of these time periods are actually close in amount. The exception here that sticks out a little is the IT-related. And again, that goes back to that pension administration system project that we're working on. We budgeted large dollars. We think that that'll be much heavier in the second half of the year. Let's move on and look at professional expenses. We've broken these also down into four categories: legal, IT-related, kind of accounting, actuarial, audit, lumped them together, and then all other professional expenses. When we look at the actual for the 6 months for this group is $851,000 in expenses. The budget is $968,000, so we're about $117,000 or 12.1% under budget for the first 6 months. Legal expenses were more than expected based on our current litigation expenses during the first 6 months of the year. The accounting, actuarial, and accounting and audit expenses are $116,000 less because the actuarial expenses are less because of the timing of the work that's being performed in the second half of the year instead of the first half of the year. When we look at that same chart, we'll see there's a little more variability in the professional expenses. Again, as you look at the accounting and actuarial, that's the largest variance there. Again, that relates to the timing of the actuarial work that'll be performed in the second half of the year. A little bit in the IT, again, on that pension administration system. Finally, let's look at investment expenses. So here in investment expenses, we're looking at items like investment due diligence, custodian fees, investment portfolio operating expenses, investment consulting and reporting, and fund management fees. And these are direct fees only, not the indirect that are paid by the fund. Overall, these expenses for the first 6 months of the year were $3.3 million, and that compares to a budget of $3.4 million. And so we're about $65,000 under budget or 1.9%. The large items here are the investment portfolio operating expenses, and that variance is related to larger than expected legal fees with an investment manager, and partially offset by the timing of appraisal, audit, and other investment-related expenses. And as we look at fund management fees, they were less than we budgeted at $394,000. And that's because of negotiated fee reductions and then the timing of some of the fees. The last three pages are the account details. So every account, same three periods where you can see the dollar and the percentage variances, and it's sorted by the largest variance to the smallest variance. So you can go each page, just look at any account, what was their variance, a positive or negative. I want to point out on the last page at the bottom, you'll see the allocation to the supplemental plan. And this is how that is allocated between the regular and the supplemental plan. Are there any questions about the budget? To actual?
I have a question.
Yes.
I know when we made the budget, we didn't anticipate legal fees just because we didn't know. I think it's safe to assume our legal fees are going to remain higher than we anticipated for the second half of the year. Is it possible to increase the budget in the middle of the yearly cycle so that we know we're not going to be able to hit that number? Right, I would think, the legal fees.
I mean, they're $71,000 over budget at this point, and they're not over the total budget for the year yet, but depending on how the next 6 months develop.
And I'm only asking just because of optics.
Yeah.
I don't want anybody to say that we did not hit our budget. The unforeseen legal fees, we didn't see it.
So we can do a budget amendment. Actually, we're probably going to bring one to the board next month for your consideration, not on legal fees, on the actually sound system for this room and video. But, Josh, do you have a projection of whether you think we'll be over for the full year, or is it a little too early to?
You know, it's really, a little difficult. I mean, I could put a pencil to it, sharpen a pencil. I mean, with active litigation, it's not a precise science. If our case with the city ended up settling, then that would, bring those legal fees down. So it's really a little difficult.
To me, this is a lesson on making sure with the right GP.
Investment
portfolio operating expense. That's a huge, all because of previous
primarily one
decisions by previous boards years ago that got us with a GP. That's just a lesson learned. The hard one.
Well, you're going to have over and above additional legal expenses aside from the litigation with the city with respect to the turnover of the portfolio. There's some things that you don't expect, and when we need to get rid of a manager and look for a new manager, there will be additional costs incurred, and we're using outside counsel for that as well. So these are things that maybe it wouldn't hurt to have a contingent going forward on next budget.
Next meeting.
Yeah. I'd rather be safe than sorry.
One thing, actually, and I've never done it, but I've heard enough complaints about it. Should we budget something to try to improve the virtual participation?
Yes, that's what we're going to bring next month. We hope to have it this month, but we want to have a cameras and video systems so people can see and hear better.
I don't think we need to go that far. Why don't we just get
I bought some cups on Amazon and I'm going to put some string.
Okay.
And it's going to rob you there. He's like, yes.
Thanks.
Any other questions?
questions about the budget?
No.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We will move on to the financial audit status. The field work has been completed for the most part. The valuation memos for Huff and for Lone Star have been completed, and they are with the auditors. We expect those memos to be reviewed by the end of August. Financials, as you heard earlier, have been sent to the actuary, and now that the experience study has been completed, work on the actuary report will begin, and as they said, they'll be back in September to present the results of the actuary report. And we expect then to bring the audited financials and the annual comprehensive financial report back to the board in either finished or nearly finished status in October. Are there any questions about the audit? Okay. I'll move on to the quarterly financials. Report. I want to start the second quarter financial review with the bridge chart. The bridge chart represents the net changes, in net position over the period by adjusting for investment, benefit, and operations-related transactions during the period to arrive at the ending net position. So we began the year with a preliminary net position of just over $2 billion. Investment-related transactions have increased the net position by $139.3 million, and benefit and operations-related transactions have reduced the net position by $40 million, and we have ended the six-month period, June 30th, 2025, with a preliminary net position of $2.134 billion, and that's up $99 million since the beginning of the year. Next, I'll briefly discuss some highlights from the financials. The combined statements of fiduciary net position compares the results from December 31st, 2024, to the results from June 30th, 2025. And that first section is investments. Total investment value at June 30 is $2.067 billion, and that compares to $1.939 billion, or an increase of $128 million. And that increase is primarily related to changes in the public market. As you can see, equities is the big winner along with fixed income. As we look down the page to cash and cash equivalents, we see that cash has decreased by $27 million since a year end, and that's due to benefit payments exceeding contributions. The next schedule that I want to look at is the changes in fiduciary net position. And this schedule compares the results from June 30th, 2025 to June 30th, 2024. And the first section here is contributions. City and member contributions increased by $14.55 million when compared to last year. City contributions increased by $10.9 million. And if you recall, in 2024, contributions exceeded the floor and were based on 34.5% of comp pay plus the additional contributions of $13 million. Beginning in October of 2024, the city began contributing based on the city plan. Overall, member contributions have increased by $3.66 million year over year, due to increased salaries and staff levels. Regular and supplemental member contributions increased by $3.8 million and were partially offset by a decline in pension buybacks of $176,000. Employee headcount has increased 277 when compared to prior year levels. As we continue to move down the schedule and look at net investment income, it increased by $42.5 million year over year due primarily to changes in the public markets. And as we come down into deductions and we look at benefits paid to members, they've increased by $1.748 million year over year. Service pensions increased by $536,000. Survivor benefits increased by $1.34 million. And these increases were partially offset by declines in disability payments, which declined by $153,000 over last year. New service retirements at higher monthly benefits is the primary driver in the increase in benefits paid to members. Are there any questions about the financials?
Question on the page before. What are the foreign currency transactions that were involved?
RBC funds.
Yeah, I mean, I think what would show up here is any thing in the global equity separate accounts. Likely, we're not funding any like private investments that are in a foreign currency. So that's probably what would get picked up here.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Turn it over to Kelly.
The next three items are mine, and they're the standard items, so I'll be very quick. The first one is the ministerial actions. There's for August, there's nothing unusual here. We had 21 refunds, 9 state payments, 5 survivor benefits, 13 retirement, so nothing unusual. I did want to mention one of the members who did pass away during this month was a former board member, Dr. McCollum, so I recognize his service on the board. Any questions on this report? The contribution update, the city's contributing based on their plan, as they have been, so that was expected as well. The accumulated shortfall between the city's plan and the plan that the board has adopted is $10.5 million, starting with the new fiscal year. So that's going to continue to grow while we work through this process. And then the next item is the board members' education and travel. Sasha has listed for you some training that's available if anybody wants to attend to the list of motions. Is there anybody wants to
one thing for disclosure, I was unable to attend TechFirs. I think this conflict, so I have asked to do that. I was going to fund it out of my talk, but I was not.
Okay. All right. And I just want to remind you, if there's other classes or education that you want to attend that's, you know, pension appropriate, let us know. If you're not restricted, just speak, and there's a budget. All right. Oh, and the next item is to report out from the tech versus cat attendance.
Yeah, so I'm going to actually both went to the tech first yeah, it was typical. It was good. It was a good event, and there was some good information. I'm still waiting on an email from a young lady who did a presentation on the El Paso, City of El Paso public and budget pension, and I wanted it broken down. She gave the numbers for all the employees, and I wanted to know police and fire. But overall, good. A lot of people, and probably because we sponsored it this year, there's a lot of discussion and push towards crypto. And I think everyone knows my opinion on that. And then a lot of more information on AI, and it was good information overall. It's still a great conference to go to as far as, it's always interesting to talk to people from different plans. I talked to a guy, El Paso, retired. So far, I remember talking about how $50 million short on their pension. The city paid. They were $210 million short by the time they finally came to a decision. And then now they're in a very good place, fully funded, and they have $1 billion. And so it's a common problem. We're not the only pension in the country. We're having
that has disagreements with the city. But yeah, overall, it was slanted a little more towards stuff. The AI stuff, they're talking about, we can save you money by basically having a computer answer the phones and talk to. I don't would appreciate that, especially our retirees. I think they want to talk to people. Overall, it was good. It's always good to just get different perspectives on everything. And Leo moderated the discussion on crypto. That was interesting.
Yes.
I'm not into crypto. But overall.
Yeah, two quick comments. AI is going to take over the world. That was one conclusion. The second presentation by Dimensional was really good. By Jay, who's been actively involved with Dimensional for a number of years. One, that consensus is usually wrong. And two, you really don't want to react in any kind of environment, because whatever happens is going to be wrong at the end of the day. You're better to take your time, do your homework, and go forward. And he had I think he went back 20-some years in terms of magazine front page, as far as the world's coming to an end, this is the new rebirth of investments. And in each case, that was the peak or the bottom. So it was good. Good presentation.
Which is why AI is not really going to take over the world.
Yeah,
right.
Right.
They're saying that. Everybody's throwing money at it. You know.
You said Dimensional? The gentleman you're friends with was Dimensional. Jake.
Yeah. That's it. Although there was a trip out into the hinterland that some of the people took, which was interesting. Buses broke down, no air conditioning.
Oh, really?
New
Mexico.
Yeah.
For an awful, awful wine experience. We will
do
New Mexico for wine.
I've had worse.
I think you have a pretty refined palate.
We didn't.
I
had a long discussion about ice wines in New York, and I heard those are worse. So I'm glad I wasn't on the bus that had no air conditioning. I was happy, but yeah, it was a great. From El Paso to
104 degrees,
But the gentleman who were on the bus, we had a great discussion on their negotiating with their city manager about their contract.
All right, on portfolio update. Maybe a little question to El Paso in August next time around. But so year to date through July, we're up 7.8% on the overall portfolio, up 10% on the public markets portion, which is now 80% of the assets. So performing quite well. A few actions within the portfolio over the last month. We did an equity rebalancing from the public equity portfolio in late July. We had a few managers, WC and Boston Partners, that had done quite well, so we trimmed those back to the 6% target. Same thing in the RBC emerging markets. Redeployed $20 million out of the $37 million into the passive IMI index fund and held $17 million back in cash. So I thought, given where we're at with some of those managers and equity valuation levels, a good opportunity to raise some cash and hold some back in the portfolio. On the private market side, we're at $15 million in year-to-date distributions. We received $8.8 million was our share. It was a partial distribution from the Lone Star portfolio company sale that we talked about last month. Good news there. And then the U.S. small cap manager that we talked about last month, Eastern Shore, we liquidated their account. They liquidated their account on August 5th. We funded $60 million into a passive Russell 2000 index fund that's also with Northern Trust. And we talked about last month, we're kind of looking at the small cap exposure. Us and McKee are going to come back with some recommendations to the IAC, likely at the October meeting, on what to do, any changes potentially in the public equity portfolio. And then if we maintain exposure there, it'll likely end up in an active replacement down the road.
How many basis points for small cap replacement?
Four basis points. Very low. But let me pull it up real quick. 2 basis points.
Okay.
Management fee, 1 basis point, admin cost. So we're in very low cost arrangements with Northern Trust on both the ACWI, which we have quite a bit of money in, over $400 million, and now this placeholder on the Eastern Shore, or the, on the U.S. small cap.
Okay, great.
So looking at investment initiatives, got a lot done first half of the year. In just a few minutes here, we're going to talk about the multi-asset credit selection and funding, but looking through to the rest of the year, we, on the private market side, we have a subcommittee meeting next week to talk through kind of current pipeline and next steps, but moving our focus on from the direct lending to secondary and a traditional buyout, private equity funds to review, and then some additional opportunities in private credit. We have, the other thing we're kind of thinking through is we likely have 3 public searches probably over the next year plus on the public side of the portfolio with global equity value, potentially U.S. small cap, and then a second multi-asset credit manager. So just trying to prioritize which of those should go first with the team. A few market charts, just looking at the yield curve. The light gray line is the U.S. yield curve kind of beginning of the year. Orange is end of June, and the blue is end of July. You can see there's been just with expectations of potentially rate cut coming in September, drops pretty significantly in the kind of short and medium term part of that curve, with the kind of 2 to 5 year coming down the most, and then a pretty big drop in the 10 year rate as well. I found this chart interesting. It's from Apollo, but this is looking at the CPI calculation and then what percentage of the prices are estimated each month when they do that, and you can see a massive uptick in the use of estimates from March forward. So it usually is about 10%. It's up to 35%. It seems to be a combination of kind of staffing cuts at the BLS, tariff uncertainty, and what the actual prices are going to be. So I think it just goes to reliability of economic data and you know, the market's trust in the numbers that are coming out. Looking at moving to public equity markets year to date, this is as of last week. International EM still outperforming U.S. by a considerable margin. July was kind of U.S. catching up, and a lot of the tech stocks rallying. Moving forward to our portfolio, 3-year public portion of the portfolio up 11.8, so quite strong performance, even with 2022 included in there. On our public equity portfolio, 2 managers performing quite well year to date. Interestingly, our deepest value manager and our deepest growth manager, highest growth manager with Boston Partners and WCM. Looking down at Eastern Shore, they won't show up next month, but even with their struggles, they had really turned it around in the last 6 quarters. So since inception, they actually outperformed the benchmark. I think it's more of an issue. If you look at that inception return, or that even that 3-year return on small cap, it's just trailed large cap considerably over that time period.
Ryan, are these numbers net or gross?
Net. So yeah, anything we'll show you guys is going to be net of all fees for each of the managers.
Because you know where I'm going, which is what's the argument for not just going passive on every we're actually net getting?
Yeah, so I mean, long term, you have to go to the long term. You know, year to date, we're doing well. We're outperforming net by 20 basis points long term. It's not huge, but over time that adds to real value to the portfolio. But the discussion we had at the IAC a few weeks ago on public equity was, you know, what to do about small cap, what is the right active passive split to have in the portfolio, and then emerging markets, what to do there. So, like I said, we're going to work with Makita over the next month or so, bring some recommendations back to the IAC. I got some initial thoughts from the committee a few weeks ago, but we'll run that through and come back with any recommendations.
And then the next question is looking at how much of this is active. You know, have you guys given any thought, given our funding ratio, but have you given any thought to security lending or strategy overlay?
A little bit of thought, not a ton. Securities lending we used to do, and it kind of became a black hole with the board, and just we were spending way more time on it than the value we were earning out of it. And that was in a much lower rate environment, so it may make more sense to make some actual income lending securities now. I think on the overlay, you know, we have a pretty healthy cash allocation. We have a lot of cash outflows, but I think, you know, as we get some other stuff in the portfolio and look to some other initiatives, that could be a way to be a bit more efficient with our cash allocation. And, you know, that cash outflow is going to drop over time.
Are we set up to do futures and options and so forth with the bank?
No,
okay.
Not at this stage. So, I mean, we've talked to managers that kind of overlay managers that can help you with that in the past, but we're not set up to kind of pull any of those levers internally at this stage.
Can you start giving, because, again, I declared where I am on this, which is no COLA, and let's settle and get some cash in here.
Mm-hmm.
The other side of that is we get some cash in, that's going to give you more degrees of freedom. Do more things. So let's start thinking about what we can do when we get spouses to actually.
Yeah, like, I mean, based on this performance, I would say we're a bit above the tree line at this level, but there's a lot of mountains in the horizon. So, but I think, like, what we're doing on the private side is kind of that, but it's, I think the conversation as a cash flow profile and funding rate improves is what is the right the percentage allocation to private. I think we're looking at what to add to the portfolio at a relatively small allocation, 6% private equity, 4% private credit. But as the health improves, we're a bit below peer plans on how much we have in those alternatives.
Right. There are a lot of things you simply can't do with this funding.
Mm-hmm. For sure. Any other questions on manager performance? Okay. So ended the month at just under $2.1 billion, pretty healthy asset level. Obviously, we have the cash outflows of $50 million year to date, but investment gain of $154. I was trying to think earlier, like, I think it's been quite some time since I've seen, like, $2.2 billion, or, you know, $2.1 is a good threshold to get to. So safety reserve, good there, especially with the rebalancing that we just did in July, but plenty of cash, short-term bonds, plenty of liquid assets in the portfolio. On the bottom left, that's looking at our overall liquidity profile, not just a safe reserve, but you know, less than 20% in illiquid assets right now. So a few things to point out on the asset allocation as Kyle comes up to the table. So the Eastern Shore, like I said, is now in the passive. We had $65 million in that account. We funded $60 million into the passive, so it was an additional $5 million back to cash we were able to get there. And then as we're about to move on to talking about the multi-asset credit search and recommendation, the funding source for adding that manager, if we look to the public credit allocation, Aristotle Pacific is our bank loan manager, and Loomis is our U.S. high yield manager. We intend to fund the multi-asset credit allocation by drawing those from a 4% allocation back down to a 2%. So with that, we'll move on to the multi-asset credit recommendation. Kyle led the search. We're going to be recommending ICG as a new multi-asset credit manager within the public credit allocation. For benefit of the new trustees, just wanted to give a bit of history on how we run the search process and how this multi-asset credit concept came up. But, you know, with the 2017 legislative changes and the establishment of the Investment Advisory Committee, we've since then been running all the heavy lifting on any public search through the Investment Committee. They'll review the RFP, the search criteria. They're the body that interviews the managers as we go through a search. This is our sixth one we've completed under this model, so each time I think we get a bit better on what we're looking at, how we're going about doing it, how we're working with Makita on a search. So very pleased with how the process is working at this stage. Going to the multi-asset credit concept. We started an asset allocation study early in 2024. One of the bigger changes as part of that asset allocation study was to break down the silos in the public credit allocation and combine bank loans, high yield, emerging market debt into one public credit allocation, and then with the intent of hiring, reviewing multi-asset credit managers that have more degrees of freedom to invest across those asset classes and credit added to the portfolio. So we approved the new asset allocation study with the public credit end of last year. Coming out of that, we did a public credit asset class review that established the 4% multi-asset credit. The idea would be longer or shorter term, you know, in the near term to come back and likely add a second multi-asset credit manager to kind of fill up that space and then maintain a standalone emerging market debt manager. So with that background, I'll hand it over to Kyle.
Great, thanks, Ryan. So as Ryan mentioned, this is going to be a 4% allocation in the total portfolio, funded out of a reduction in our standalone bank loans and high yield mandates. I think one of the things that was important to us throughout this search, and we'll touch on this later, is how this mandate would fit within our broader existing public credit portfolio, with kind of that ballast on either side of the remaining standalone bank loans and high yield mandates. I'll provide a brief overview of ICG Global Total Credit here before I kind of walk through the evaluation process we went through. ICG Global Total Credit is based out of both London and New York with two co-PMs. ICG is a European firm that is widely known in kind of the private credit space. They got their start in the late 80s doing kind of subordinated debt lending out in Europe. One thing that we find appealing about ICG is the inclusion of European credit in a more kind of balanced way than many of the other multi-asset credit managers that are out there. And another important note that European credit carries a whole other layer of risks that are far different than what you'd see in the United States. And we found that if someone was going to be doing European credit, it was important that they were not a tourist in that space. They had the people on the ground, they knew the jurisdictions very well, understood how bankruptcy could play out, and a number of different factors. And that is what we found with ICG. They have a depth of experience in European credit. There are two investment committees that ICG operates with in the liquid credit space, one in the U.S. to evaluate U.S. credits, one in Europe to evaluate European credit, which again just kind of reinforces the importance of having that very specific geographical focus when understanding the fundamentals of those credit markets. One of the key things that we were looking for with this move to multi-asset credit that Ryan mentioned is the ability for a manager to be tactical and to move around and find relative value between multiple asset classes. Historically, with that kind of 4% high yield, 4% bank loans, we ended up owning 4% high yield and 4% bank loans through a number of periods where either bank loans outperformed by a significant amount, which we've seen over the last several years, or high yield outperformed by a significant amount. And having a manager who's able to not just find the best bank loan in the market, but find the best credit in the market and then find the most attractive structure to attack that is appealing. So I'll go ahead and get into, I'll skip over the memo and go to our slides. But as a universe, multi-asset credit is probably one of the most ill-defined out there. Managers self-select into investment universes, and there is a very wide range of what people label as multi-asset credit. Some managers might include up to a third in emerging market debt. Others might include up to a third in investment-grade credit. And so it was very important to kind of sift through those in the weeds from the get-go. So after an initial screen, just to kind of weed out ones that don't fit basic criteria for us, we ended up meeting with 23 different strategies with those portfolio management teams before narrowing our list to the 11 products that we included in the RFP. I want to note on the 11 products that we received a request for proposal from. Many of these would be good complements to ICG Global Total Credit, and it was very likely that in a future multi-asset credit search, we'd see some of these same names come up again. And we got very comfortable with some of these approaches, but ultimately they weren't the best fit for the public credit portfolio today. Our semifinalists, each of which we spent a significant amount of time with, are Caspian, ICG Global Total Credit, KKR Global Credit Opportunities Fund, and Oaktree Global Credit. We then, after kind of initial review, meetings with the manager, and meeting with Makita to discuss, narrowed down to the two finalists who were brought to the IAC on July 24th, ICG and KKR. A couple of the key criteria that I just want to point out here. I've already mentioned the appropriate fit within our existing public credit portfolio was of high importance to us. But additionally, given that 3% standalone mandate to emerging market debt, we wanted limited to no emerging market debt exposure through the product. We also wanted limited exposure to illiquid or private debt. Some strategies in this space may be doing as much as 25% in illiquids or private credit. We felt that if that was the case, they should be able to articulate what those holdings do in the portfolio, the role they play, and how they affect liquidity very clearly. We found that few who do include private debt to that extent were really able to articulate the role it was playing in the portfolio. And we also wanted to limit exposure to investment-grade credit outside of kind of opportunistic defensive positioning. So getting to our finalists, just a brief kind of overview. ICG Global Total Credit was incepted in November 2017. That kind of came out of the initial European multi-asset credit product that ICG has going back to 2012. It currently has $1.2 billion in product AUM, but there's a number of searches they're actively involved in, and the vehicle, a specific vehicle that we would be in, is $800 million in AUM. Kind of drilling into some key kind of characteristics of these portfolios, I think what you'll see with ICG, and again, this is a snapshot in time as of 3/31/2025. These things move around across all these portfolios. But ICG and most of the ones here in the semifinalists, except for Oaktree, are much more concentrated approaches. So you'll see 169 current issuers in ICG. Run rate, that should be expected around 125. But in kind of tight credit markets like we have today, they're going to be a little bit more diversified while they're waiting for that dislocation to take advantage of. Significant concentration in the top 10 and 25 issuers. But compared to KKR Global Credit Opportunities Fund, a bit less in those top positions, but they also have a much smaller tail. And ICG is very cognizant of what role each position is playing in the portfolio. I also want to point out one kind of key difference in the mandate for ICG is they're able to and have in the past done some distressed debt investing up to a very small 1% allocation in their portfolio. That has allowed them to kind of bring the powers of ICG to bear in certain situations and extract value for investors. And then I just want to point out here the five-year upside and downside capture. I'll note this is against the U.S.-only high-yield leveraged loan benchmark, so you're seeing some of the impact of investing in European credit during some of these dislocations. But ICG has had a 121% upside capture and a 40.7% downside capture over this time period. Getting into our scoring here a bit, and we've covered some of this on ICG, but ICG also offered a very attractive fee compared to what we've seen from similar strategies, and we were able to negotiate that a bit further down. We also found that the firm's presence in Europe and growing presence in the United States establish a really strong foothold in the EU and gives them the resources that are needed to do credit right in that market. With that, I think I'll pause and see if Tom or any of the other IAC board members would like to share thoughts from the interviews or takeaways, and then we can go into questions.
I'll just say, great process, a lot of detail, a lot of insight, and you know, good time with the with the managers, but all things considered, we really, from the IEC side, we really appreciated the Makeda insight overall and their ratings and and perspective. We like the organization. We came away very constructive on the investment team, their philosophy and process. And, of course, performance and fees are very competitive and in line with what is expected for this asset class. I should note that it was a unanimous vote for ICG as well.
I look at this very good work, excellent work, very thoughtful, and I like the process. My comments are a bit more strategic. One, full position allocation. How do we look at that? So, what is a full position? What is a half position? Given our current, you know, posture.
I would say like a full position in equity is a 6% allocation. We might look at increasing that a little bit. We lowered that from 8 a few years ago. In credit, it's a 4% position. So we're kind of taking the other two to half positions and this to a full 4%.
And again, coming back to the same, because I'm going to train on a practice going to serve. And so if we get fresh capital because we resolve and increase our funding ratio from the city, do we add to these positions? Do we bring in another manager? How do we balance the portfolio?
I think we would
add taking half positions and add to on, or closed in fund and closed. We take a half position so we bring up manager in. What's kind of our
I think maybe we would expedite the second MAC manager to bring in the 4% as dollar value of the fund rise will increase. I think, you know, where we're at in public credit is probably a good long-term position at 11% plus the investment-grade fixed income in the portfolio. We're also, you know, this is a very liquid product. You know, we wouldn't want to draw from it in a period of distress, but we'll also have funding needs into the private credit portfolio. And we're kind of looking at, you know, a funding source for private credit is public credit, funding source for private equity is public equity.
Yeah, one of the references we talked to a state plan on the East Coast, they use this ICG Global Total Credit product to park cash while they're waiting for capital calls on their private credit commitments. So that could be a good place to, you know, if we had capital come in, you know, while we're searching for those great private market investments.
And I mean, it was interesting going through this. We just got done with the private credit direct lending search. And they're doing the same type of work just on the public side as opposed to the private side. But these are primarily sponsor-backed, privately held companies you're lending to. It's just a form of the credit.
Well, you don't get the drag, like on the private credit, you know, asset drag, or 10% of the portfolio. You're going to get stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's obviously much more liquid and trading. But
yeah, those are my
only
one, tactically, how we reach the allocation. I wanted to understand what a full position is.
Yeah. And I mean, I think when we look at their outperformance compared to some of the other peers that we looked at, I think it is their ability and willingness to move in and out. You know, initially, like maybe it's a European exposure that's causing that performance, but really it was their shift into bank loans at an attractive time over the last 5 years that's benefited them.
And then Ryan, Kyle, what is our posture with regard to currency translation? So if part of the portfolio is non-dollar, hedge against that?
So they internally within the portfolio do hedge out part of the currency risk. Just since it's a dollar-denominated fund series that we're going into, I'll let Ryan speak to kind of.
Yeah, I mean, we have not hedged any currency exposure across the portfolio. Historically, I mean, if you look at the performance here today on the equity side, you know, not most, but a big share of the international performance is a currency drop of the dollar there. So we haven't got it historically. I don't think we would intend to, but it's a good point.
Yeah, we're all over the map.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think it's just important to understand kind of what's driving the returns, whether, you know, what impact that would have, what is leading to that. The relative returns in U.S. dollars.
And again, I think these are hopefully the types of things we're going to need to start thinking about. We can get more investment capital.
Yeah, realize, too, is as the portfolio continues to get more diversified on a global basis, in a sense, we have a natural hedge.
Right. So. Yeah. Well, you know, Tom, our posture at TRS is we didn't hedge.
Yeah.
We hedged to make sure we got the value of the close and settlement after that.
Yeah. We only use hedging when we had receivables for over a period of time.
And so,
very intimate situation.
But then the dollar amount is smaller here.
Yeah, longer term, as the fund continues to build, there's a lot of opportunities that, you know, we can take advantage of, whether it's futures, options, you know, these are all things to think about for the future.
Yeah.
But things we should do is, like, one wrong turn, and it's over the cliff.
Yeah. Yeah.
Understood.
Well, any other questions on IQG? All right.
The company, from when I looked at, it was the part but I thought it was good. Because I initially followed KKR, because obviously they're much more well known, but I thought the comparison of IQG was a lot better.
Yeah, I mean, they're both really good, but I think the kind of uniqueness that ICG brought to the table was a good fit, given what we currently have in the portfolio. And then I think. Think more about kind of who do we pair them with, what's a good fit to complement them in the portfolio.
Yeah. Both came in and presented, so we spent a lot of time talking through that, right?
Yeah.
Manager risk and manager reputation. Mm-hmm. So it was pretty well vetted.
So the with that, the board motion to approve them would be to authorize the executive director to enter into an investment management agreement with ICG. With a 4% multi-credit allocation.
Good motion. Second. Motion to second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say nay. None. Motion backwards.
Right. Thank you.
Report on the advisory committee.
I'll mention a few things. And we've covered a lot of it in terms of the credit surge, but the point came up on small cap equity, and one, whether or not this is an area to give some attention to or not, but just recognize that this is an asset class that's less efficiently priced. It does provide some diversification benefits. Yes, inflation and business cycle issues can come back to haunt you at a point in time, but it's something that you know, the committee seemed to definitely indicate something to look at and continue to be involved with going forward. Another point came out in terms of the global approach in terms of active passive. And yes, it's cheaper to do passive, but if you can find some great managers, you can pick up some great incremental rates of return at the end of the day. And if anything, it may not hurt to give more attention to the active side, given the opportunity as we go forward. Emerging market equity exposure, no conclusions. Bias toward active, but there will continue to be concerns over, you know, what, how, and where emerging markets go, as well as China. So, to be determined. Anything else?
On the active passive discussion, I think, you know, we have a bit of a quality tilt in our active managers, so it's just hard for that portfolio to keep up in a big market like this, but it should hold up well, and it did in 22 on the downside, being a bit more defensive. But yeah, I think Colin said we have some work to do and recommendations bring back through the IAC in October, and then some additional searches on the public coming out of that. We had a few new members on the IAC, so that was good.
Yeah, I think the exciting part, I mean, you can get into active, passive, growth, value, all these things, right? But the exciting part to me being new to the committee is, like, so much of the return of the overall fund is going to come from, I don't want to speak for you, but kind of going into these areas, right? As we get capital and can deploy it, like, how do we actually build this out, like, in a professional way to get exposure to different asset classes? That's going to drive much more of the return than are we active or passive, you know, in a different manager style selection. So exciting to, for me to be part of the committee, because I think we're finally starting to be offensive, you know, versus defensive for where we've been for almost 10 years, right?
Sure.
We need to...
No action needed there.
We need to go to a closed session.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Go to a closed session.